This is Dr. David Black, founding director of the American Mindfulness Research Association. My guests today are Dr. Gammon Earhart, professor of physical therapy with appointments in neurology and neuroscience at the University of Washington School of Medicine in St. Louis, and Dr. Kerry Rawson, assistant professor in physical therapy. Dr. Earhart is the director of the program in physical therapy, a Worthingham Fellow of the American Physical Therapy Association. Part of her research program focuses on movement and movement limitations in people with Parkinson's disease. She has a new research study with Dr. Kerry Rawson, funded by the National Institutes of Health, that addresses Parkinson's disease symptoms with mindfulness-based stress reduction practices. Welcome, Dr. Earhart and Dr. Rawson. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here.
Wonderful. So I became aware of your work because I track federal grants monthly, and I'm always looking for those good and new solid ideas, and really seem like your group had a solid idea here. This is a clinical trial planning grant. It's titled Moving Mindfully, an MBSR-centered approach to freezing in Parkinson's disease. So I really want to learn about Parkinson's disease, about freezing, because it seems like a highly novel approach that I haven't read about at all. So maybe I'll go back and start basic. I'm really interested in physical therapy, human movement, kinesiology. In particular, your work, and both of you can talk about your work. Can you describe the basics of where you began with human movement? It seems important for people to know, like, movement sciences, and then we'll connect that to Parkinson's disease. So we know where the beginning of this research program came from.
Yeah, absolutely. So at Washington University here in St. Louis, here in the program in physical therapy, we actually have a movement science research center, which is a whole collection of investigators who are focused on studying various aspects of movement, whether from the standpoint of orthopedic conditions, neurologic conditions, metabolic conditions like diabetes. We sort of cover the whole gamut of potential things that could impact and influence movement. So our group in particular is interested in how neurologic conditions and particularly neurodegenerative diseases impact movement. And we've been studying that since 2004 now here within the program. And we have a very collaborative team that focuses primarily on movement in people with Parkinson's disease.
So the movement, so I'm assuming limitation because, you know, I had a grandparent for many years that we saw the outcomes of this, and, you know, it's scary for everyone, you know, to lose mobility, to the intentionality of movement. For those not aware of Parkinson's disease as a neurodegenerative disorder. So can you tell people what happens? So, you know, why are the movements, you know, why are people losing their ability to intentionally move, and what might that look like?
Yeah, so in Parkinson's disease, there's actually a loss of a specific sets of neurons within the brain and brainstem in particular. And those neurons normally help to regulate movement and help us to pick out the movements that we want to do and execute those movements effectively, while at the same time preventing unwanted or competing movements from interfering with what we're trying to do. When these particular neurons are lost, we see a disruption in that balance between desired movement and competing movement. And that manifests as slowness of movement, as smallness of movement. So we call that bradykinesia. And the other hallmark features that go along with that that are used to diagnose someone with Parkinson's disease are rigidity or difficulty turning off the muscles when you don't want them to be active, along with a tremor that's present at rest, and then postural instability or difficulty with balance.
So I'm assuming there's a spectrum of early stage and people starting to voice concerns, recognizing changes. And then what I was seeing later in life in a family member is just almost complete loss of control and people assisting in daily life care. The beginning stages, because I'm trying to, you know, as we move forward, I wonder where a mindfulness program might fit best. At the beginning stages, what do we see, and what do you hear reported by individuals with PD?
Say early on, it typically manifests in a couple of different ways. Some people will just notice a slight tremor in one hand. and really not think too much about it. And they may not be formally diagnosed for several years after noticing that initial symptom. Other people will report that they notice maybe their foot catching on one side as they're walking. But oftentimes early on, it's very subtle. And then as you mentioned, you know, it is a progressive degeneration that's occurring. So people do go through different phases. Difficulty with walking is something that typically emerges pretty early on. Many people don't appreciate that, but that is something that does happen early. Again, the changes can be more subtle at first, but become more pronounced over time. And that's one of the biggest concerns of people with Parkinson's disease, is that ability to remain mobile and functional and to walk. So that's something that we focus on particularly in our work.
Yeah. And so the challenge in movement from a first person perspective, is it like lifting the leg? Is it freezing? Is it just a loss of strength? How is it usually reported?
I would say it typically just looks like somebody's walking slowly and with small steps. It's not that they are unable to walk more quickly and with longer steps. And in fact, with attention to the task and cueing, like take big steps, people can do that. So that's very different than, for example, someone who may have had a stroke where they can no longer recruit the muscle regardless of the intent or the instruction. So there's something about sort of the default patterns that are selected as being slower and smaller than usual. And I think that the freezing is something that happens later on in the disease process and something that we're looking to target, particularly with this grant. And Carrie can talk a bit more about what freezing is and her idea for how to address it with mindfulness.
Yeah, the freezing of gait. So we talked about the early mobility limitations. And one more question on that. It just seems so interesting to me, and from an outsider, and this may not be as interesting to you now because these are small questions, but is it the subjectively perceived that the person is feeling slower, or is it objectively perceived from others? So does a family member notice something is going on and the person is like, oh, I don't notice it? Or is it always that the individual themselves is like, I just don't feel fast to respond in my mobility?
I think it's a lot of times that the family members kind of notice at first that they are walking slower. And then we have equipment like the gait right mat, where we can actually objectively see the differences in how the disease progressed, so that we can actually measure stride length and walking capacity, speed. And so we can actually see it. They are walking slower too.
So yeah, I find that very interesting. So like there's the sensory piece where others may recognize that the mobility is slowing or a gait is slowing, but the first person perspective might not catch that too quick. I find that very interesting. Do you think this is part of the neural connection that might be also having an effect on perception? Maybe because I feel like if someday, like tomorrow, I just started being slower in my movements, I wonder if I would even notice something like that. Do you find that an interesting, maybe it's not the most interesting question, but I find it so interesting that a person's perception of themselves might not catch the slowness factor.
I feel like it's kind of, you know, it's not like it just happens overnight. It's a progressive slowing. So, you know, they just kind of become accustomed to it and they might not understand it at first. But I mean, some people will, like another one of the hallmarks is when they're walking, they'll have reduced arm swing, at least on one side of the body. And so a lot of our participants will notice that. That will be something that they recognize, that their arm isn't swinging as normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure this is, you know, scary for everyone involved and families, you know, witnessed it too. It's, and you want it to go away, but these are the things that may not be going away over time. So it's important that we address it, right? And it seems like your group has figured out at least one option to test that out. And you all are focused on the freezing of gait. So maybe we can talk about that. You said that's more at the progressing end of limited mobility. So what is that in particular?
So, I mean, as the disease progresses, and not everybody that has Parkinson's disease will get this. I mean, it's usually about half the people will progress and get in with freezing of gait. And it can be described as like your feet just get kind of glued to the ground. And so you just get stuck and you can't move. It can last for some people a couple of seconds, and it can, you know, other people, it'll last like 30 seconds and they actually need somebody to like help get them moving, or they need some kind of tricks to help to get them move again. And so it's an interesting, you know, it's a huge fall risk. I mean, so sometimes it just happens when, you know, like you think you're getting ready in the morning and you're in a small space, like a bathroom, or you're cooking dinner and you're turning a lot. And so then you might get just stuck while you're turning. Then other times it'll happen when you're, you know, you just get up and you start to initiate a walking, and then you're that first step, you get stuck. Other times people have problems when they're going through narrow spaces or through doorways, then they'll get stuck, or transitioning from maybe like carpet to tile will kind of throw them off and they'll get stuck. So all the different ways that it can happen is interesting, and something that we hope to address in the mindfulness walking meditations.
Wow. So this seems very interesting. So there are actually like moments that are predictors for when this might happen.
Right.
And it seems like, so what do we know about that? That seems so interesting. So we have some kind of visual cue in the environment. There's a transition space, maybe indicated by texture or color. And what is the forcible action here that's creating the freeze, do you think? Because is it the transition gives more information, and that information kind of gets in the way of intention? And so, or is it just by chance, it is those moments that people recall that they thought it was the transition to, say, tile from rug? It seems like a really interesting process that might be at work. Do we know much about that from like the lab work, and what might be causing the problems in those transitions?
Yeah. I mean, so after this planning grant, that is something that we want to look at more, is like the biopsychosocial elements of it. So there is definitely some research that points towards like cognitive you know, inputs may be overwhelmed, and then emotional processing. So anxiety could be a major thing too. We kind of think of it like maybe it's just kind of like a cognitive emotional overload. And so you're just having those inputs of cognitive abilities, your anxiety, and then that motor input, maybe they all just kind of get stuck and then you get stuck. And so, you know, we're hoping with the mindfulness intervention that maybe we can kind of quiet down or the anxiety and cognitive components and allow that motor component to do what it's supposed to do. So actually allow them to kind of walk and not get stuck as much.
Yeah, that seems very interesting. So maybe something on the cognitive, what I'm hearing, maybe on the cognitive side, the informational processing piece, like given that there's degeneration, the normal pathways somehow are being disrupted. And maybe it's environmental cues that pose more information, like transition to materials and colors. That seems extremely interesting. And then the second piece, somehow anxiety, I don't know, being either the outcome or the precursor to it. Do we know much about that? Because see, this seems very complicated to me. It's so momentary, right? So you mentioned the person is possibly cooking, or, you know, intentionally going to step over some kind of trespass, and it occurs. Is it often that we see, do we know anything about the anxiety occurring that the person is aware of prior to that happening? Or does the anxiety typically coincide with the realized inability to move at that moment?
I think that's something that we definitely want to learn more about. Like right now, research kind of points towards some kind of bidirectional relationship where people, you know, it may be that people have, you know, kind of like generalized anxiety already. And then when they get stuck, you can get this fear of falling. So, you know, and that could, you know, increase their anxiety even more. So, you know, it's definitely trying to figure out if it's a chicken, the egg, or both kind of thing. And so once we get through this planning grant, what we would like to do is look more into like, you know, some kind of longitudinal study or different kinds of cross-sectional studies that will provide more information on which comes first.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, we would all probably feel anxious if we couldn't intentionally move in the moment. I'm assuming it might be something akin to like a straitjacket effect, where all of a sudden you found yourself completely tied up and bound. And I don't know if that's the sensation, but something along those lines. And then wondering what happens next, right? Because we just have lost our locus of control. And then you bring up this important point where falling is related. And this seems really important. Person with progressive neurodegenerative disease and the risk for falls have really bad outcomes, right? So if you fall, it's not a great outcome. Talk about fractures, bone breaks, and other things. What is typically the report of individuals? Is that like their most feared outcome? To be stuck, frozen, fall, and get injured from the person and the families?
I wouldn't, I'm not sure if there's any like certain papers that say that, but just from talking to people, then yes, like that is one of their number one fears, is that this getting stuck is going to fall. I mean, especially for people who freeze when they're, in the midst of walking. And so you have that momentum and then all of a sudden your feet get stuck, but you know, the top of your body wants to still keep going. So, fear of falling is definitely a major issue for people with Parkinson's disease and freezing of gait. And another component that we want to look at in this mindfulness grant to try and, figure out more about how that impacts their freezing or their anxiety.
Yeah, the way you just put it really brought it to life for me. I'm like, yeah, you're walking forward. Of course, the fear is that if your lace just freeze up, I mean, what are you going to do? And then the location. Okay, so I think that leads us to the question of the location of the freezing. Is it leg specific? You said it's almost like, frozen feet to the ground. Are the other parts of the body remaining mobile? So at least there's like a fall technique. I'm imagining like, okay, if this is going to happen, is there like a fall guide that people can most likely, if they can at least control their upper extremities, fall in a way that they're going to impose the least harm? Is there some strategy? It seems strange, but it's almost like we have to, in a way, teach people how to fall if this might happen.
So there are certainly methods that we use within physical therapy if we feel that the fall is inevitable, to try to train people and practice falling safely. There is also evidence that freezing can occur in other parts of the body. So there's freezing of handwriting, there's freezing of speech, freezing of eye movements that have been demonstrated across several different studies. So it seems to be some sort of phenomenon that's more global than just freezing during walking. I don't know of any evidence to suggest that when you're frozen during walking, that your upper limbs are simultaneously frozen. So I would think that the normal postural reflex responses would be there, which may or may not be a good thing, because you may end up, falling on your outstretched hand, which is not always a great thing.
Exactly. But that's what I was wondering. I was wondering if it's like an Aikido roll that you can train, you would need your lower body as propulsion most likely, but it's a good point. It's like, if people are going to fall, and probably it is an unconscious reaction, somehow PT could make that conscious. I wonder what a safest fall might look like, if that even exists. Would it be a stomach fall, a shoulder fall? I'm just wondering what part of the body can you protect? Most importantly, I'm assuming the head, of course. We somehow want to protect our head from hitting.
Yeah, you definitely want to protect the head. The hip is the other concern, particularly for people who freeze while they're turning, because we know that falls during turning carry an 8-fold increased risk of hip fracture compared to falling when you're walking in a straight line. So that's a particularly concerning combination of freezing during turning, because it's a very dangerous time to fall.
I see. Yeah, that is an important point. And I see your focus on gait now after our conversation, why it's so important. It's like, that is the, even though there are other freezing factors, like ambulation reduces in arms and in riding, but in gait, it seems like that's a high risk moment, perhaps the highest risk moment for fall and hip fracture. It makes a lot of sense. And so you have this mindfulness program planned. And one of the reasons it struck me, it makes a lot of sense, because in mindfulness proper and like a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, participants learn a lot about embodying what is happening in the sense world, right? In pleasant, neutral, unpleasant sensation. So you really try to help individuals get into their body. So it makes sense to me. You're trying to bring them into their body. And so then where do you take that? Oh, and your second part is you bring them into their body, and this is focused on a mindful walking program, if I understand it correctly. Mm-hmm. So the gait elements are infused. It's making a lot of sense. And so can you go with that to the next level? What is it, the elements of mindfulness that make a program like this promising?
So I think that's a great intro. So, I feel like, before I got introduced into mindfulness, there was my head and then there was my body. It was connected by the neck. There was nothing very exciting about that. And so, once I started learning more and more about mindfulness, then just seeing how we do need to connect those two things, and how important it is for us to be more aware of our body and body sensations. And so with Parkinson's disease, I feel like there's even more of a disconnect, not intentional, obviously, but just disconnect between that mind and body. So could mindfulness come in and try to compensate for what's being lost in, the normal disease progression, and try and, just like when you have, some bad neurons and other neurons try and come and compensate for, loss during stroke, like, could it be that same kind of concept? So by teaching people mindfulness, can we get them more in tune in their body? And then another big component is, the people with Parkinson's disease and freezing of gait, and it's the anxiety. And so the mindfulness component that teaches you that self-compassion and that kindness, and helps to reduce the anxiety you have, can that also help somebody like in the moment when they are having a freezing episode, can they quickly do some kind of mindfulness thoughts or breathing to get them out of that frozen situation before, or even, when another atmosphere. So a lot of people will, in large crowds, or like when they're getting on an elevator, those high stressful things where you have to move, or you're in a line and you have to move, like, could they start breathing and thinking about that mindfulness components before they're about to step to prevent getting stuck? So I think there's a lot of different, just the mindfulness, everything about it, I think it's just going to be really helpful for these people.
Yeah. So those mechanisms are really interesting to me. And maybe let's piece those apart, because I think the field as a whole also tries to understand, like, really what's at work here. And your first piece about getting people into the full experience of the body, mm-hmm. that seems so relevant, especially when the body seems like can become a burden, right? So I'll give an example here through like sports injury, because a lot of us at some point have perhaps gotten physical therapy for various things. And the reason I always like physical therapy as some kind of integrated model with a mindfulness program is because what physical therapy had done, at least for me in my experience, is really trying to get you to see where you are in your body, where you can get back to, right? So this would be years of sports injuries that I would have, like every 3 weeks playing football or running track, we always would get injured. And we would work with the physical therapist, and we'd always want to just get back, like, get me back tomorrow. I want to get back tomorrow. And there's this drive to feel normal, whatever that means for the person, to feel back to their baseline. But part of what seemed to be physical therapy for me is to wait with enough patience to be in the body, to give good feedback about the truth of what you're feeling, the sense, the pain, and an attitude that was kind of open. I need to see what happens, right? Because we all wanted to get back, but we knew if we went back too early, we would just be injured again. And it was always a hard line to know. I still feel it. I'm not 100% sure I should be going my all out. And that right there was a really good dance with getting to know mind and body, right? Where am I psychologically? What do I want to do? What can my body actually do? So it really made me think about mindfulness, right? And you were saying entering an elevator. It's like, in this moment, if the person has practiced enough, am I ready, right? So would it be maybe something like, oh, in this moment, maybe I don't get on this elevator. I'll wait for the next one. I'm just feeling overwhelmed, not prepared. And something like that might prevent the fall. So it's something around knowing the body so well. Maybe there are times to act or not. Do you see that being one of the functional elements, an awareness of when the body is prepared or not?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, like as people become more in touch with their bodies and in tune with it, then they'll know, like, maybe they'll be able to be better able to sense when they are going to get stuck or not. And then, you know, yeah, definitely waiting for the next car would be fine. Or if they're able to just, you know, when they know that they're waiting before they push the button, you know, go ahead and use some of that training that they're going to get during this program to reduce that anxiety, you know, do some of the breathing exercises and then see if that can help them move when they want to.
And I'll say anecdotally, I can think of one patient in particular who seemed to have figured this out on her own. So she had very severe freezing that would happen consistently every time she walked. It would happen at some point. Not necessarily highly predictable. You know, it wasn't always triggered by one of these things that we've talked about. It sometimes, you know, she's out in the middle of an open space walking straight ahead and suddenly would get stuck. But she knew that in that moment, continuing to try to push herself to get her foot unstuck was just unproductive. And so she would just stop and take a deep breath and just sort of regroup. And she had, you know, a mantra of, you know, just slow down, take your time. And she would just tell herself that. And then once she was, you know, focused in again, then she could initiate again and keep going. So it seems like, you know, some people do come to this on their own, but it's not a widely taught practice.
Yeah, what a telling case example. And then it brings up some thoughts for me on, so do you think in the moment with a situation like that, I'm imagining the pause happens. Okay, this is good. I'm recognizing not to push myself. And I thought that was a really interesting piece that you asked. And I can see myself and us as humans wanting to do this, and the same with the example I gave with physical therapy is just push it. It's frustrating. I'm just push through it. If that type of, so I thought there was something, and tell me if I'm wrong here, like with PD, the intentionality of the movements, and then there's some kind of disconnect. So this freezing happens. But then if you try to like force the movement, that's even greater cognitive intent, which might even reduce the ability more. If I'm understanding how this process works, is that true? Like, so now you're really trying to force an intent. Do people then freeze up more because it's not a like unconscious, relaxed process? It's more of a higher order, like I'm trying to push myself now that I know I can't do something that just seems to happen naturally? Or am I misunderstanding how that works?
No, I think that sounds about right. And then, I mean, as they try to move more and they're more stuck, then you got that anxiety component that's coming in too. And so even more resistance of it. So, I mean, a lot of times right now, like the kind of common ways to get over with freezing is, you know, if we see a person that's stuck, we can put like our foot in front of theirs and then that triggers something in their brain and they can step over our foot and get moving again. There's also like another trick that's called 3-2-1 go. And so they kind of just, they count backwards and they're able to go. So again, they're just, you know, they're taking away that major cognitive and anxiety component to be able to start moving again.
Oh, those are really interesting practices. So presenting a new stimuli is the foot in front. It's like a reorientation of attention.
Yeah.
And then the movement can almost happen naturally again. And then the second piece, it seems like it's a different approach. It's a distraction. It's like refocus attention on something that doesn't have anything to do with movement. Mm-hmm. And perhaps there's like a reset or this unconscious gate element that happens. I don't know, but that seems so interesting and relevant to what we do in the embodiment under mindfulness practices. So let's get to the anxiety piece then, because as we know, mental health has kind of been like the core focus of a lot of mindfulness-based practices, especially in the context of like persisting stressors or persisting chronic disease. So I've looked at various stressed groups like dementia caregivers, right? So the caregiver population we know is one of the highest stressed groups. There's a lot of promise for high stress, high anxiety, where we can reduce that, at least that immediate intervention, and with some effects lasting perhaps over a year. So with a mindful gate program that's rooted on mindfulness, and especially walking, mindful walking, you want to talk about anxiety some. So just, is it the generalized feature of just overall coping better with what this progressive neurological disorder offers, or is it momentary? Like, okay, I learned a tool, I'm going to use it as I'm walking.
I think that's what we're really still trying to figure out. So, I mean, I can imagine, you know, when you're first diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, it's going to create a lot of anxiety. I mean, you're going to have major life changes. I can see where you're going to start worrying a lot more, even before a lot of the symptoms start to appear. Like, you're going to have to worry about changes with your job, your changes with your, what kind of cognitive changes you are going to have, what kind of mental health changes you're going to have, who's going to be able to help you, how fast is your disease going to progress? Is it going to be slow or progressive? And then doing a bunch of research to try and figure out what you can do to slow down the disease progression. So I think you have that huge component. And then as you get more into it, you're going to have, with the freezing of gait, then you're going to have more situational anxiety or anxiety attacks, some avoidance behaviors. Also, you may not want to go out as much because you're scared you're going to get stuck. So you're going to have more sedentary behaviors that's not good for Parkinson's disease. What we've seen shown in a lot of our studies here is how important exercise and movement is for slowing the progression of depression. So well, given you have more to say, there's so much to be going on here with anxiety, and it's definitely something I want to get more into with this grant. So like the first two parts of the grant, I'm able to work with some patient stakeholders and really hope to get firsthand knowledge of what exactly they are experiencing so that we could use that information in designing this new intervention.
Yeah, and you bring up a lot of good points about just mobility itself. And that's another thing that drew my attention to the project is it's a mindful approach. So it's mindful walking, which is something we commonly do in mindfulness-based stress reduction programs and in retreats. So I've, you know, sometimes have gone so far as done a 2-hour mindful walking approach, and you're in a huge open field and there are other people, and you're using all the meditation mental processes that you've learned, and you're just applying them as you walk with the sensory world, right? So the steps, so some descriptors here, right? The steps are very slow and intentional. Right. There is the process of recognizing each step, going from the back of the heel towards the front of the foot, the release of the foot from the ground. So if you saw people doing this, and I think there's some magazines that have put this in the cover and stuff, you see people doing this, you wonder, what are you doing? This is so strange. So you just witness it. Doesn't look the normal to an extent, but if you're experiencing it, and especially if you try it for longer than a few minutes, you recognize like, wow, there's a lot of mobile actions at work here that I tend to completely ignore. Mm-hmm. And so if you had, I'm wondering about a time question here. In your anticipation of such a program, how often might a person need to be doing a mindful walking program to start to recognize how to use it in their daily life? I'm assuming not everyone's going to want to do it, and they'll just see it as another walking approach. Like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to walk, but I'm going to be a little more aware when I'm walking. And then I imagine some people will really get into this, like, wow, it's, this in a way is going to be my new approach to moving myself around in the world. So how much time do you think we need to be dedicating to this in this group?
So I guess like my initial thought is, so we're going to be using that, the mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook by Bob and Alicia, and as our basic workbook. And then, you know, within that book, there's like a lot of different meditations that are focused on sitting, lying, yoga meditations. And then there's like one walking meditation. So what we want to do in our first part is in this advisory group is come up with walking meditations that fit the themes of each chapter, and also kind of are, you know, recommended for the different types of experiences where people mostly see the freezing. So I want to, for each week, I want to devise an additional walking meditation that we will practice like in the lab. And then, you know, if it's, if we find it safe and feasible for these people to practice this at home too, then that's fine. But mostly we want to have, you know, the people in the lab so that we can make sure that they're safe, so we can put gait belts on them, that we can have research team members next to them while they're learning this walking meditation. But if we can have them do homework too, that's great. But I think mostly my homework is going to be more the focus of what's already in the book, so that they can really learn the ins and outs of mindfulness and then be able to apply what we're doing in class.
Yeah, it seems like this skill, yeah, the skills are intertwined, right? So sometimes, as in the original MBSR manual, you would introduce gentle yoga stretches, not yoga proper, because a lot of people don't have the intense skills to hold postures at the start.
Right.
But you integrate the mobility elements of the body so people are willing to entertain what you're trying to do, the deeper work on mind, recognizing mind states, allowing those to pass. And some people don't want to do that, just sitting there early on, right? They want to move because they feel that energy, and that energy can be tension. And in particular, your program seems really interesting because you can do that same thing in the context of walking, which is the behavior. You want gait to be well controlled so the person is safe, right? And it seems like it makes a ton of sense because it's the actual behavior we're wanting to target, right? We want strong yes. gait. We want intentional gait. So it seems so important, right, to actually practice the behavior while in that mindful head type, right? So the approach to walking, and as you said, it's really important, the approach of non-judging. So here's like the key elements, right? So we're walking in the grocery store. It's, you kind of sense, you know, if you have Parkinson's disease, it's some, in a, you have gait freeze, something is kind of on the horizon, and then getting very frustrated, tense. And I can imagine like these things in the lab could be so interesting to measure, right? So what else is happening when this person becomes anxious that then is like a feedback loop to the body? Like, okay, here we go. We're just going to get tied up here and frozen because now my thinking mind is also putting a lot of pressure. That pressure, as we talked about, being like intentions. I need to be doing this now better. And then judgment, like, why does this always have to happen to me in this moment? And I can imagine having a psychological toll as well as possibly a physical one, which it seems like you're going to be exploring.
Yeah, definitely. Like I've noticed a lot of people, I mean, they get frustrated with themselves when they can't move, and they take it personally. And so, I mean, that's one thing I loved about the mindfulness is, you know, reducing that judgment, stop judging yourself, you know, and then the self-compassion that goes along with it too. Another, you know, you mentioned care partners also earlier, and we wanted to try and include them in this grant, but it didn't work out. So maybe in the future, but, you know, how much stress that they go through with all the changes that their partners are going through. And so being able to, I think, have the mindfulness program that includes the participants and their care partners. So the care partners are learning just along with them, and if they need that self-compassion and that kindness and not to judge themselves when they fall short for caring for their partner would be really interesting too.
And you know, you're mentioning you have this great equipment, like assessment equipment as people are walking, and you can keep people safe. Mm-hmm. Are there any metrics that you can pull there that would be relevant here? Like, can you actually detect if mindful walking is different than normal walking? Because maybe it's just actually doing something physiological, right? We don't know this, but the placement of the feet, the way we are walking, the way we are attending to walking. Is there a chance that just by mindful walking, you're doing something else that could protect against freezing?
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting. So we do have the APDome sensors that we can put on like their wrists and their feet around their waist. And so we're definitely going to be like in some of the evaluations looking, you know, we'll have a baseline measure of that. And then we plan on doing it again, you know, after the intervention and about 8 weeks afterwards. So we can definitely look at how the mindfulness intervention has changed that walking pattern. I think it could be interesting to actually put them on the sensors on while the people are doing the practices too. No, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, it seems really interesting to me just from a practical standpoint. Like we wonder what we do differently when we're mindful walking. We tend to think it's all perhaps something we're doing in the mind, but I think just kinesthetically, we are changing something. Yeah. And I wonder if that just changing the body posture is kind of a therapeutic process on its own, right? Because what does the body do when we're typically walking in a rush, non-conscious? I don't know how we're posturing. I don't know how we're moving. Are we leaning forward and putting too much pressure on certain parts of the body? And that would lead to a freeze. Because if you've done like mindful walking programs before, it definitely is a postural change because the forward leaning, which I perceive we tend to do when we're caught in our minds, we're thinking about the next thing to do. And it likely reflects in the body, I'm assuming, with forward leaning orientation. But in mindful walking, when you're doing step on the back of the heel, observing the process, and you feel the sensations on the bottom of the foot, that alone is telling me we're actually using the body differently. And I just wonder what the intervention is. It is using the body differently, the mental elements of what's happening when you're using the body differently, or both. What do you think's at work there?
I would guess it's both. Just again, from clinical observations, a lot of times we do cue people to make sure that they strike with the heel first and roll through the foot because they have a tendency not to do that anymore. That's sort of their default gait pattern. So I do think part of it is the focus on moving differently. But then there's also the piece of just the attention shift versus, you know, being focused on the external stimuli that might trigger freezing or allowing the anxiety to pervade things. So I think it's complex. I mean, freezing is notoriously difficult because it's so different from one person to the next, even, you know, the reasons that they freeze or the situations in which they freeze, the cues that will help them get out of the freeze differ from one person to the next, and they differ over time. So, you know, it might work for somebody this week to do the countdown, 3, 2, 1, go. And then next month that doesn't work for them anymore. So I think getting at this broader approach with mindfulness rather than a specific type of cue is a novel way to look at this and hopefully will be more effective longer term for people.
And the pedal element there, hoping using that term correct. So the foot's placement on the ground, that was a really interesting point for me. So you said this changes the rolling of the heel to the toe. What do you see happening progressively in the differences of the foot to the ground?
Well, as people start to take shorter steps, they tend to be hitting with more of a flat foot rather than with the heel. And during freezing in particular, what we often see is that people might rise up onto the toes, at least on one limb. So one foot will be planted firmly on the ground and the other foot they'll just be on their toes, and the heel is sort of bobbing up and down in a trembling type motion as they're trying to get unstuck.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this seems very important. A physical element of that perhaps this mindfulness program might address through mindful walking. So do you think the intentional element, let's say a person's been practicing, they still have mobility, the freezing happens. If they can maintain, so through a mindful walking program, if you can maintain that rolling movement, like on a day, if they're practicing this daily, I mean, I can imagine that's like a physical therapy in itself, but you have to be present and you have to be attuned because it's easy just to like, okay, forget this. I'm just going to walk and I'm getting to the grocery store. I'm done with this. But if people are willing to adhere and say, I don't know, do it 30 minutes a day, 20 minutes a day. I don't know what the time frame is going to be. Is that intervention? Do you think that's a physical therapy intervention in a way that can prevent freezing and perhaps longer term losses if people are consciously walking in that way that seems to be the choice for the body to have like better strides?
Yeah, I think so. With like continued practice, I'm kind of worried, like at the beginning, just adding another component for them to have to attend to, maybe a little rough to get started. But, you know, as I've been becoming more familiar with the mindfulness literature, is that, you know, it's not something that you're just going to be able to go and do, and the next day you're going to be an expert and be able to do it. But it's just like learning a sport or learning an instrument. You got to practice and practice and practice and practice to be able to get good at it. So hopefully over time, then yes, that would be beneficial once they become just more in a habit of paying attention to their walking.
And what, so the interventions we have to date, I think it's, you're building on something. And you're building on a novelty, a different approach to address these issues. You mentioned a few things, the step over technique, the countdown technique. Do we have any other like gold standards? Because I'm trying to see like where we are and like where this could take us. Do we have anything else to date to manage freezing of gait?
There's a cane that can shoot a laser out down on the floor that'll help. So if you don't have another person walking with you, then you can push the button on your cane and it'll shoot a laser light on the floor to help you step over that.
It's interesting. Okay.
Yes, there are some people, but again, it's, you know, like Yaman said, it'll work for a little bit and then go off the rails. Music. So Gammon's also, we're running another study looking at music therapy for people with freezing and walking stuff. So she knows more about that, the metronome.
Yeah, so there's something about in training to a beat and stepping on the beat that may facilitate keeping the pattern going. And so we're looking at that currently, not specifically targeting freezing so much as just enhancing the basic walking pattern.
Oh, these are very interesting interventions. So something it's sensory information added to the environment, and it seems to, and so one's on the conscious level, perhaps the visual cue. So we add a line and not sure why, but it gives, I don't know how that works, but there's something, a line's put in place. Did we ever figure out that mechanism? Something's put in place. There's like a visual cue and somehow it's like an unconscious response or something to fall forward and step. And this seems complex. It seems very complex. And this other one is audio cue, that some kind of rhythmic element, like a dance, where I wonder if it's something along the lines where people kind of fall into a dance. It's a very unconscious go with the movement that's kind of bubbling up rather than top down. Are we getting back to that system where it's the unconscious tends to rule, and if we could trigger it through these elements of visual cues or rhythmic cues, that there's some kind of mechanism at work that allows people just to more naturalistically move?
I would say we haven't gotten there yet, but when we're using these cues, it's still very conscious and attention demanding. You know, people are thinking about, okay, I have to lift my foot to step over the line, or I've got to match my footfalls to the beat. So it's not to the point where it's an automatic or unconscious thing. But I think with training, that may be a possibility. And that's something we're looking at in a different study, is if you use particularly rhythmic cues, even your own singing, like if you can match your footfalls to your own singing, can you over time make that sort of a more automatic pattern and less attention demanding?
I see. That makes sense to me. I was getting it a little backwards there, but yeah, that makes, so in the beginning, and this is, you know, participant report helps a lot here, right? So it's like, what are you experiencing right now? Like, I'm really trying, like I see the line and I want to get over this. Okay. I need to remain calm and here I'll do it. And the goal is over time to be able to do these things faster and faster, hopefully create a habit, head towards like a habitual response to some type of cue, so they don't have to like think and intend so much around it. So, okay, that makes more sense to me. So anything else you want to say about this project? Seems highly novel, and it's a new look, a new take on using mindfulness training for addressing a really important problem, which is freezing of gait and Parkinson's disease. Any other things you all are excited about moving forward on this project you want to talk about?
I'm just really excited about the whole thing. So like the first part of the grant is going to be forming an advisory board with physical therapists, research team members, mindfulness instructors, and the patient stakeholders and their care partners. And for like 12 weeks, we're going to go through, you know, make sure everybody's on the same page on learning about what freezing of gait is, what mindfulness is. We're going to go through the chapters of the mindfulness-based, the workbook, and also look over that, you know, the standard operating procedures for a regular MBSR program, and then see like, what kind of things do we need to modify? So there are a couple of research articles already out there looking at mindfulness and Parkinson's disease, not freezing of gait specifically, but they've had to make some kind of modifications. So instead of like the all day meditation program, like maybe make that half a day so that people don't get so tired. And then once we have this new mindfulness-based walking therapy program, we're going to do an open pilot with people with Parkinson's disease, and they're going to be super helpful and hopefully in giving us a lot of feedback on what we can do to make this better. And then once we have that, we're going to make our third version of this protocol and do a small RCT. So we'll look at people with the Parkinson's disease. Half the group will get the intervention, and the other part will actually get like usual care. So they'll just get some basic freezing of gait information and note their like medical management, their doctor's visits and stuff like that. So then from all of this information, we hope that we have to hit a lot of feasibility aims and benchmarks for NIH. And if we hit all of those, then we'll be able to move forward to looking at more of like, what is the underlying mechanisms that make this mindfulness intervention work, and hopefully do some more larger effectiveness trials.
I'll piggyback on that and say that Carrie mentioned the NIH, and we're certainly grateful for that funding from the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. I think there's an increasing recognition of the value of some of these non-traditional approaches, like mindfulness and dance and music. And so that institute has been very supportive of that type of work in our lab.
Well, best of luck on this highly novel project. And I look forward to seeing the results. We can conclude for today. Thank you so much, Dr. Earhart and Dr. Rawson. I hope you have an opportunity to enjoy and learn so much about this very important issue. Our listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org, goamra.org, where you can support us by becoming a member or subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.